The first part of tonight's prepared portion is actually going to be a rebroadcast of the phone-in session last week. Unbeknownst to myself last week, the entire phone-in session was to be taken up with a single phone call from a woman who is a journalistic colleague not only of the late Joseph Daniel Casolaro, but also of Harry Martin of the Napa Sentinel. I was not aware of her, nor had this phone call been planned. However, in the past week, I have made contact with her and learned more about the journalistic milieu of which both she and Harry Martin and the late Joseph Daniel Casolaro are part of. What we're going to be doing tonight is I'm going to rebroadcast this phone call from last week's prepared portion, and then I'm going to take another musical break, and we're going to come back with Virginia McCullough, the woman whose voice you're about to hear, and Virginia McCullough is going to update us on what has transpired since the program you're about to hear, or in the last week, I really should say. I'm going to, in my conversation with Virginia, attempt to sum up as best I can the information presented in this phone call. I would strongly encourage those of you who are in a position to do so to tape this information. It is critically important, and I think to a considerable extent, the regaining of effective political control over our destiny will depend in considerable measure on the exposition of the information and of the various ongoing investigations, which the late Joseph Daniel Casolaro termed the octopus. So what I'm going to do is to replay this phone call. It's about an hour and a quarter or so, maybe a little more, and I will play this for your benefit, for the benefit of those of you who did not hear this. And I would note also that the information from 2 weeks ago concerning, actually last week's broadcast, the information concerning Daniel Casolaro and the phone call you're about to hear and the updated phone call, which I will be presenting you with, these will be included as a miscellaneous archive show about the assassination of Joseph Daniel Casolaro, because it appears that's what it was, and that will be on permanent file with archives on audio. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. So we're going to proceed now with the phone-in session of tonight's broadcast. We'll see if our equipment collaborates here, cooperates. Good evening, Sano. Can you hear me?
Good evening.
Good evening. You're live on the air here.
Hello, Dave. How are you?
Very well. Been better, but hanging in there. How about yourself?
And hanging in there also. I'm calling you about the reporter that was killed in West Virginia.
Joseph Casolaro.
Danny Casolaro.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And Danny Casolaro was the second reporter murdered in a month.
We did read an account of a Mr. Young being killed in Guatemala earlier this day, I guess in July 29th, according to the press account.
Correct.
Okay.
And there's a reporter that's gone into hiding whose story ran Saturday, Eric Reguli. And he writes for the same network, the Financial Times, that Mr. Ng did.
Okay.
And they were working on the same story, the story that I was working on a part of, too, with Danny Casolaro.
What can you tell us now? Obviously, the press accounts indicated that his suicide, quote-unquote, was mysterious. I'm extremely skeptical that it was suicide, as are many other people. You have stated unequivocally that it was a killing. Are you in a position to safely disclose to us any additional information about that?
After my name was carried in the Associated Press accounts, I was contacted by a man who met with Danny Casolaro in the parking lot of the Sheraton Inn because Danny was afraid to go to the hotel room. He met with Danny between 5 and 6 p.m. for 45 to 55 minutes. He gave him 50 to 60 pieces of information, part of it proprietary information from a manufacturer, a defense firm. And shortly after 6 p.m., Danny called his family and told him that he was on Interstate 81 in Pennsylvania, headed home for a family birthday celebration. And then just like Dexter Jacobson in Sausalito, Danny Casolaro apparently, for some reason, pulled off of that Interstate 81 and ended up in a hotel room that he was afraid to take his contact to for being afraid that the hotel room was bugged. And according to all the reporters that I've been talking to, his clothes were found neatly laid out on the bed.
Right, that's carried in the press account.
And open bottle of wine on the bathroom floor, no alcohol found in the body.
Mm-hmm.
There were 8 deep slash wounds to the right arm, he's right-handed, and 4 deep slash wounds to the left arm. It probably took 20 minutes for him to die, and the only other sign of trauma to the body was a bruise on the upper right inside, or upper left inside arm and the bicep.
Interesting. So he was bruised on the bicep.
That's correct.
One wonders how that would jibe with the suicide scenario.
it's more important to me as to what the police are doing back there in West Virginia. I first heard about it shortly after the family heard about it on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
When we heard about it, I contacted the Martinsburg Police Department, Sergeant Schwartzward, and I asked him, well, I told him that it was murder.
Mm-hmm.
And that he had a crime scene, and that there was a string of murders. This is the fourth such death since March the 21st. And I related the deaths to him, and I faxed him the documented material. He assured me that it was a preliminary determination on suicide, and that the crime scene was being protected. On Tuesday, I was faxed by the Arizona Republic the information that the body had been embalmed as soon as the police found it on Saturday, before the relatives were notified.
Which is, of course, illegal.
Which is, of course, illegal and certainly is not in keeping with a proper police investigation. And in addition to that, the room was industrially cleaned. Now, you don't protect a crime scene by industrially cleaning a room. And you don't lie to a person who calls and tells them that there's a string of murders and tell them the crime scene is being protected.
What can you tell us about some of the other killings? Obviously, we've heard about Mr. Young and obviously Joseph Daniel Casolaro. Are you in a position to give us any other information about the other two killings?
Yes. There's a man, and I don't want to read his obituary, all right?
Okay.
Next. I don't want to hear the police and the government saying that there's a fat Italian sitting in a Pierce County jail who dies of a heart attack. How tragic. Because there's a man named Michael Reconosciuto.
Okay. By the way, that's a name very well known to this audience.
I understand that, and his son was and is probably in danger.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in touch with Michael since roughly about February, about the same time that I started hearing from Danny.
Okay.
I was put in touch with him in part by the Hamiltons of Inslaw.
Okay, by the way, that's William Hamilton and his wife who developed the Inslaw Company. Go ahead.
Yes, William and Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
And he put me in touch with several different writers who are working on different tentacles of Danny Casolaro's octopus. And Michael started calling me on a regular basis. I've also met with and talked with his wife, Bobby, and their children. And we were trying to put together the scenario. I'm writing two books. The first book involves a man named Charles McVeigh, who is called the Techno Bandit of the Decade.
Mm-hmm. He was involved, by the way, in the Star Wars software spying case, and also McVeigh was involved in the TOW missile deal to Iran.
Well, let me say this about Mr. McVeigh.
Mm-hmm.
You assume that. The first book that I'm writing is called Kevin Justice on Trial, and it deals in detail with the so-called Saxby supercomputer case, the 1987 setup to bring Charles McVeigh back into United States jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in daily touch with Mr. McVeigh.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight he's in the hospital in Canada. He has won both cases against extradition by the United States government in their attempt to bring him back into the jurisdiction of the United States.
Right.
There'll be a shocking revelation in that case in the next 2 weeks.
Okay. By the way, caller, if for some reason that does not come to my attention, if you could see to it to call that piece of information to my attention, either mail me or fax.
I'll mail you the court papers.
Okay. Thank you.
And in addition to that, my touching stone in dealing with Michael Reconosciuto was Charles McVeigh.
Okay.
And he was dealing with the Russians 20 years before the United States government considered it popular.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight, as we speak, Mr. Gorbachev, of course, has resigned. But given that fact, at that time, we considered this country, the Soviet Union, an evil empire.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, there were two people that I'm talking to who did not. One was Mr. McVeigh, the other was Mr. Reconosciuto.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Reconosciuto apparently was a CIA operative, and he wanted out of the company. And he started calling Bill Hamilton roughly May or June of last year.
Mm-hmm.
continued to call them, and Bill called me in November and said that one of the bankruptcy club victims, that's the second book that I'm writing, had contacted him and indicated that I knew of Michael Riconosciuto. I said, yes, but I didn't know that you knew him. And he said, well, he's been calling me anonymously from pay telephones. He's terrified for his life. He says that the people that he used to work with and the government that he was close to is now chasing him, and he's afraid for his life.
Mm-hmm. I can understand why under the circumstances. Go ahead.
On March the 21st, Michael Riconosciuto, I guess the closest term I can use is decided to do an outing. He decided to come out of the closet and just try to go home to Mama and the kids. He wanted out of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a declaration that to the United States government was devastating, because he told it like it was, that the United States government was using Indian reservations as sovereign nations through the CIA to manufacture and produce arms and weapons for the Iran-Contras.
Caller, I was wondering, did you hear the work that I did on the Inslaw case involving Harry Martin's accessing of some of that very same Michael Riconosciuto information?
I've been force-fed you, even though I don't get your radio station, by friends and allies. I'd say for the past year I work closely with Harry Martin. A lot of the information that you have broadcast on Rusbacher comes from Rodney Stitch and myself. But there's an army of people out there whose technology is being controlled and laundered through by the United States government, mm-hmm. political cronies.
Okay.
And that will be on a couple of shows shortly. Probably Inside Edition, I would suggest you read People magazine.
Okay, and by the way, once again, if I should miss some of this information, because I'm I put my pants on one leg at a time and I'm limited in terms of resources, if you and or some of the other associates of yours would see to it that the information finds its way into my hands, I will put it on the air.
I would appreciate that, because that is our protection.
Right. I understand how it goes. Go ahead.
And in any case, as a result of Michael's, of my believing, and a lot of good reporters, Channel 9's Janice Wykowski, that's Channel 9 Australia, these people have believed in what Michael Riconosciuto said from the beginning. And because they believed, they dug. And Danny Casolaro was one of those who dug the deepest. We finally were told by that illustrious gentleman in Canada that if I was ever going to have my feet on the ground in doing my research, I had to trace the money, honey. And so we started to trace the money.
Okay.
And, Dave, the money is a slush fund. And I now call that slush fund the New World Order slush fund.
Okay.
It came out of Southeast Asia in an organization called the Black Rose, and I do believe that Dr. Earl Bryan, who was featured with wonder today in the Financial Post, the Canadian newspaper, a branch of the Financial Times, which was String's newspaper.
Right.
All right. The money came out of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, and according to Michael Riconosciuto, Dr. Bryan, doctor in parentheses, carried the bank codes out of Southeast Asia with a form of diplomatic immunity, and the money ended up deposited in the Nugenhan Bank in Australia.
Fascinating. Fascinating. So this slush fund, the New World Order slush fund, as you term it, coming out of the Southeast Asian area, that would also appear to collaborate some of the allegations contained in the Christic Institute suit as well.
Correct. And then when Frank Hand had another suicide, he was suicided.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Nugent, Michael Hand, disappeared with the money. And in the process, just like the bankruptcy situation here, countless families and businesses in Australia were raped and pillaged. And Australia considers the location of Michael Hand to be the story of the century. So a lot of people that I'm working with are tracing Michael Hand and the millions in that slush fund that disappeared. The next time the slush fund surfaced was BBR&W in Honolulu.
And that is the aforementioned Bishop Baldwin, Rewald, Dillingham, and Wong, which I touched on earlier in the broadcast.
Correct. And then there was apparently a civil outing of Mr. Rewald that resulted in his defense, which apparently was, I'm sorry, I'm working for the government. That's my defense.
Mm-hmm.
The judge said, wait a minute. this court record is sealed due to national security.
Right. And in fact, you know, the very short quote that I, the very short section that I played from my interview with Daniel Sheehan on November 4th of last year followed immediately a discussion of Ron Riewoldt's role in helping to broker some of the Exocet missile sales to Argentina during the Falklands War. And one of his associates in that, according to Dan Sheehan, was Heinrich Rupp, one of the people also whose name has cropped up in connection with the October surprise scenario.
I offer you another name.
All righty.
Mario Renda. Mario Renda was brokering huge funds for the savings and loan.
One of the individuals, again, who has cropped up in connection with many of the failed savings and loan institutions, in particular, Mario Renda, has his name has surfaced in connection with many of the CIA-connected savings and loan scandals that, from the book Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loan. Also, the name of Renda crops up in a big, big way in the miscellaneous archive series that I did about the CIA connections to the savings and loan scandal. By the way, caller, I'm reciting these references for the benefit of listeners that might want to pursue some of the documentation for your very pointed comments. Go ahead.
I appreciate that, Dave. A new name, Bill Sia, Glazier's Union, Los Angeles.
Can you spell that for us?
No, I can't because my contact couldn't spell it for me.
Okay.
Or I'd be on top of it by now.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Michael Riconosciuto is in a very unique position to know whereof he talks. Mm-hmm. I do believe he's a CIA operative, but more important, and for your listeners, I know him to be the son of Marshall Riconosciuto, who is a close friend, longtime friend, and business partner of W. Patrick Moriarty, the Safe and Sane Fireworks King, Red Devil Fireworks Pyrotronics Corporation. And your listeners will probably remember that in 1985, Mr. Moriarty was sent to jail to serve time for allegedly bribing everyone from the governor to Willie on down.
I've heard that name in connection with some recent case. Can you list some of his other, briefly enumerate some of his other connections for us? Because that name rings a very strong bell for me.
All right. In 1985, I sought FBI protection because I had been given the bankruptcy papers of a corporation called Pleasanton Properties. I live in a small town of Sonol. We have a dog for mayor, and at the end of my four-mile dead-end canyon, Mr. Moriarty and Mr. Riconosciuto had purchased, along with their personal attorney, Henry Bear, 940 acres previously owned by Sinbad 720 of Honolulu, and that property was a political front. Mr. Moriarty had obtained a loan of $1.3 million from California Canadian Bank based only upon his signature. When he got into trouble, there was a deal struck.
Okay.
Between the East Bay Regional Park District to rescue Mr. Moriarty and the Bank of America, who supplied the Park District a letter of credit, a line of credit, and laundered through to Mr. Moriarty as he sat in jail $1.6 million in profit.
Interestingly enough, although it might, I don't know if it's relevant to this particular case, B of A has also cropped up as a collaborator in connection with the BCCI scandal. Also, Gunther Rosbacher mentioned that the B of A's Vienna branch, now closed, was a central financial vehicle for some of the operations he was involved in.
Dave, it goes right to the heart of the streets of America and to our children.
Mm-hmm.
The heroin bust in Hayward. All right?
Right.
I believe the people's names were Chan or Chang.
Right.
They see it was the largest white heroin bust imported from China in this century. They seized the people's home. They arrested the people. Both Black Hawk homes were seized. One later was given back to the people's personal defense attorneys. But no one seized the warehouse that the drugs were found in. And that's because the warehouse was owned by Bedford Properties. And that's Peter Bedford and his wife, Kirsten, in Kemper Life Insurance out of Chicago. And the normal practice anyone knows of the DEA is to seize the location the drugs are found on.
Mm-hmm.
This was not done in this case. Now, I'd like to get on to Danny.
Okay, go ahead.
Danny Casolaro, in our conversations, never believed that our government dealt drugs for arms until the last phone conversation that I had with him. He was upper middle class family. His father and brother were doctors. He believed in motherhood, apple pie, and the American flag. And I said, I do too, but I also believe that our government dealt drugs for arms. And we would argue about this initially. And in the last conversation that I had with him in the week preceding his death, he said to me, you know, I've come to be a bit of a believer, and I've come to share a bit of your fear. He was very, very excited. He was not down. He was very, very excited about the contact that he would meet. Michael Reconosciuto has supplied to me through a third party, as he sits in jail, numerous documents verifying a good part of what he said. Those documents are now with the House Judiciary.
Okay, good. Very good.
And they are with Senator Kerry's office, and they are with Senator Cranston's office. They're with The Nation. They're with The Washington Post.
Good, good. Interestingly enough, John Kerry, I did not mention it during the prepared portion of tonight's program, he is now visiting Southeast Asia with what he maintains are some hot leads about the continued presence of some American POWs in that part of the world. And as the book Kiss the Boys Goodbye by Monica Jensen Stevenson and William Jensen Stevenson illustrates, and that is also available from a miscellaneous archive show from Archives on Audio, that some of these continued prisoners are being covered up, or some of the continued presence of some of these prisoners is being actively covered up by elements of our government because they would reveal such covert operations as the U.S. government complicity in the drug traffic and so forth. Go ahead.
I absolutely believe all of that at this point. Getting back to BBR&W,
right.
When Reworld was outed as a result of the civil suit, I believe he ultimately went to jail, but the money disappeared. The people who had been hurt, including a large part of the population in the Napa and Marin areas who had invested in a general partnership, lost everything they had, and the government didn't repair them. Even though the man went to jail, it was like the savings and loan.
Mm-hmm.
The man went to jail, a very cushy jail, I might add, for a very short period of time, and the citizens never got their money back. The slush fund disappeared.
This, by the way, is mentioned in the Jinx case series, that the Jinx case press packet that Harry Martin has available from the Napa Sentinel. Go ahead, caller.
That's correct. And I suggest to you that when Anson went down to Guatemala, he went down there with the firm intention of doing two things, of tracing the slush fund that now reappears in BCCI,
mm-hmm.
and of contacting the key witness to a CIA triple execution, the bag man for the money, Jimmy Hughes, who fled to Guatemala when a price tag was put on his head by the family in charge of the Indian Reservation, according to Michael Reconosciuto, the Cabazon Indian Reservation in India, and that's
mm-hmm.
John Peter Nichols.
Mm-hmm.
The Nichols family, the old man in the inside job, is alleged to have been a CIA operative involved in the hit of the Allende Corporation. President Allende.
And also an associate of G. Wayne Reeder, another CIA link to the savings and loan scandal. G. Wayne Reeder among the alleged CIA operatives involved in the Silverado savings and loan orbit. The main name in Silverado, of course, George Bush's baby boy, Neil.
Correct, and they also had San Marino savings and loan. And I believe that G. Wayne Reeder also had Palm Desert Golf and Country Club. Jimmy Hughes, the man who is the bag man, or alleges to be the bag man, for the triple execution of Fred Alvarez and his friends, ended up fleeing the country and going to Guatemala. But before that, there was a lawsuit filed by Gene Wayne Reeder against Jimmy Hughes, alleging that Jimmy Hughes had made an attempt on his life.
Okay.
I'm in touch with the gentleman who took Jimmy Hughes to safety. And he currently is in hiding. He has strong contacts and inside knowledge on the downfall of Sid Shaw and Centennial Savings and Loan, which resulted in the unexpected death of Mr. Hansen, and the brief but illustrious life of Beverly Haynes.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly Haynes had as her supposed and alleged adversary two people in the Justice Department. And both of them, I say, were alleged adversaries. One was the former U.S. Attorney Joseph Russinello.
Right.
The other was the former assistant U.S. attorney.
Peter Robinson.
Peter Robinson.
Right. By the way, once again, let me jump in here, caller. The information about the Centennial Savings and Loan links with, among others, former Congressman Doug Bosco, and all of the names that this woman has just described, that is contained in the discussion of the Centennial Savings and Loan case, also in the CIA connections to the Savings and Loan Archive show. Go ahead.
Okay. And Peter Robinson had a complaint on his desk, as did U.S. Attorney Joseph Russinello. Since 1986, of the misconduct of a man by the name of Charles Duck. Charles Duck was bankrupt in 1968, and then he was appointed by Conley S. Brown, the now-deceased judge from Eureka, to become a bankruptcy trustee.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Duck is currently in the Sheridan prison camp in Sheridan, Oregon, serving time for the largest embezzlement by a bankruptcy trustee in the nation's history.
By the way, his attorney, it was the aforementioned Peter Robinson, who was also the assistant U.S. attorney allegedly investigating Centennial.
Not only was Peter Robinson allegedly investigating Centennial and certainly hugged, according to eyewitnesses, Beverly Haynes and apologized for having to convict her during the trial, but he also was appointed in violation of revolving door policy by Marilyn Hall Patel to represent one of the largest drug dealers, Mr. Becerra, from the Colombian cartel. Mr. Becerra got 40 years. When I mentioned this to a member of the U.S. Justice Department, and I said I was a little concerned because Mr. Robinson had come right out to be the criminal defense lawyer for Charlie Duck, again mm-hmm. in violation of the revolving door policy, I was assured, well, Mr. Becerra got 40 years, maybe Charlie Duck will get 40 years. And I wrote a letter to the House Judiciary at that time because we had met with members of the Justice Department, and we were told it could get violent. I met with a member of the Justice Department with witnesses August the 15th, 1989. On August the 30th, Dave, I came home after having met with my husband and I with Rodney Stitch. We both shared the same bankruptcy trustee.
Mm-hmm.
Came home late at night. We had hamburgers from McDonald's for our children. As we came up to the back door, we live in the country, a man was running out of the back door, and he had set fire to the side of the house. He ran back in the door, knocked over things on the inside of the house, and out through another door in the home in front of my children. I wrote letters to the Alameda County Sheriff's Department, to the California Forestry, who both of whom came and helped put out the fire and take the report, and to the FBI and to the U.S. attorney, and no one did anything.
By the way, let me also interject that Charles Duck, who was the bankruptcy trustee for the Lenvest Corporation, one of the financial firms implicated, financial institutions implicated in the drug tug case, the first of Harry Martin's national security-related investigative series. Go ahead.
And the defense of Calvin Robinson, who was the drug tug captain, was that he was working for the United States government.
Mm-hmm.
That he was, in fact, towing a contract load. Trust me when I say I absolutely believe Calvin Robinson at this point, and I did not when this first started. It goes even deeper, and it goes right back to the CIA, and I will make sure that a third party contacts you and gives you the name of the station chief that turned Charlie Duck over. When Charlie Duck went to jail, and two wonderful reporters, Nina Martin and Susan Costell of the San Francisco Daily Journal, wrote what I consider to be at least should be nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, the series that started in October of last year. They had been working with this bankruptcy group of victims, which number about 100 in the Bay Area.
Oh, by the way, is that the legal publication out of San Francisco?
It is.
Right, okay. I know the publication you're talking about. Go ahead.
And Nina Martin is a freelancer whose dedication and whose talent exceeds anything of any reporter I've known. They broke the story after having taped 3.5 to 4 hours of tape with Dexter Jacobson.
By the way, Dexter Jacobson was investigating corruption in the federal bankruptcy system and specifically was informing to the FBI and federal authorities about that. He was murdered under very strange circumstances, and one among the many foci of his investigation was the aforementioned Charles Duck. Go ahead.
Correct. The FBI, in its release to the girls who published that that wonderful series, October through December of last year, was that they only audited 3 of the 1,500 cases that Charles Duck had because they didn't want to beat him over the head. Let me tell you why they didn't want to beat him over the head, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Because he shared 4 bank accounts with John L. Molinari, who ran for mayor of San Francisco in the last election.
Fascinating.
All right? And Mr. Molinari and the Trione brothers managed to tie up all of Mr. Duck's assets. Mr. Russinello, that wonderful gentleman who was the former U.S. attorney, now with Cooley Goodert, is fighting giving a dime of the bond money to any victim.
Mm-hmm.
And their companies have successfully disallowed or tied up in litigation any repair to the bankruptcy victims for the rape of their assets by Charles Duck. Now, when Dexter Jacobson was murdered, the Daily Journal finally, 2 years later, broke the story. And they broke it with an interview with a dead man. The Justice Department, by this time, had been hearing about the complaints from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of victims for 4 years.
Oh, by the way, excuse me, which dead man was it? Can you tell us that was reported in the journal series?
Dexter Jacobson.
Oh, okay, right. That's what I thought. Go ahead.
He was interviewed, and then he was reported. His body was found in August on Rodeo Drive in Sausalito. By this time, people whose lives were being threatened were scared. They had a reason to be scared.
Obviously. Go ahead.
The successor trustee in one bankruptcy involving a man named Bill Conley, the successor trustee was a woman named Susan Euchre. When I went to do my research on Conley for a chapter in my book, there's four declarations of matter of court record where Susan Euchre threatened the life of Bill Conley if he set foot upon his own property.
Right, that was covered in one of Harry Martin's, part of Harry Martin's series on the corruption of the federal bankruptcy courts. Go ahead.
And the threat to his life was recorded by Betty Ann Bruno of KTVU when she took her television cameras to Oregon and the man tried to set foot on his own property.
Okay.
Susan Euchre happens to be the successor trustee to Charles Duck in the Paul Sanowski bankruptcy. The bankruptcy in which Dexter Jacobson was the contingency attorney suing.
Right.
All right. It was there he met his death. The only honest individual that I can give you in all of this and give you publicly at this time is a United States bankruptcy trustee who was placed here to clean house. And his name is Anthony Souza. And Anthony Souza tried to clean house,
mm-hmm.
and then Washington told him they didn't want it swept quite that clean.
Okay.
And they shut him down. Now, they did it politically by taking out some very wonderful assistants that he had, and they did it by putting molds in his office, and they did it by taking him to Washington and telling him to shut up. Right after Mr. Duck went to prison, and it was a slap on the wrist by Mr. Schwartzer, the judge, 2.5 years is what he got. The claims in his bankruptcy exceed $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
He makes Jimmy Baker look like a Sunday school preacher.
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Robinson said that he passed the lie detector test. Mr. Souza said he did not, and I believe Mr. Souza.
Okay.
When all of this was put together, I started doing, making lemonade out of lemons, as my mother used to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a 14-chapter book, and that's when Danny got a hold of me. And Danny wanted to talk specifically about this gentleman whose life is in grave danger as he sits in prison in Washington, Michael Reconosciuto.
Okay, go ahead.
Michael did this declaration, and I looked at it, and I thought, this man is insane. And everyone who read it thought this man was insane. And from his jail cell, somehow, through third parties, he managed to supply enough documentation to Frontline, Nightline, Danny Casolaro, myself, reporters around the country, to make us slowly become believers in what we didn't want to believe.
Right. Go ahead.
And when the contact called me, who was frightened, and I urged him again to come forward, I have his name and I have his telephone number and I have what he gave them. But Danny Casolaro was supposed to have between 50 and 60 pages of whistleblowing information involving a major defense contractor, some of it with letterhead, and if the police didn't find that, or it was missing, then I want to know who has it, the killer or the police.
Or both.
Or both. Or one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to what's happening with Michael Reconosciuto. When you're in jail, I know this from the Kevin's case, when you're in jail, you are allowed certain things unopened. You are allowed that material mailed to you or FedEx to you from your attorney if it's clearly marked lawyer-client privilege. And roughly April of this year, through several different sources, after the House Judiciary had flown to Washington to interview Michael, they asked him for credibility. Show me the documents. Michael asked from several different sources that the material be forwarded to him in jail, clearly marked lawyer-client privilege.
Mm-hmm.
It was. By law, they're not allowed to open it. The jail opened it,
mm-hmm.
refused to hand it to Michael Reconosciuto. Instead, they called the National Security Agency, who sent out a team to review the material. Now, that was April. Michael Reconosciuto has not yet been given that material as of this morning when I last talked to him. But what did happen is one of the parties who managed to get it to him had contacted a couple of attorneys. One of the attorneys was a very high-profile attorney by the name of Dennis H. Eisman. He's the Fatal Vision lawyer on the Peter McDonald case.
Mm-hmm.
He was a partner at one time with Siegel.
Yeah, that's Jeffrey McDonald, right? The Green Beret dentist who was accused of killing his family?
Correct.
Right, go ahead.
And Eisman was handling the appeals. He was working with the former FBI agent, now a private investigator by the name of Ted Gunderson. And he was scheduled to come out to meet with a third attorney and visit Michael Reconosciuto to represent him in jail, in the Pierce County Jail. Before the Associated Press releases came into my fax, before I knew or the media knew anything about this, Michael Reconosciuto called me and said, they have killed my attorney in Philadelphia. Would you please call certain people and tell them they've killed my attorney? And I said, what are you talking about? They shot him to death. Shortly thereafter, in contacting the media that evening, I was able to get faxed to me the AP report, where the government alleged they were going to bring down indictments against Eisman, and they also named other attorneys for money laundering and dealing in drugs. And therefore, they had to assume that Mr. Eisman was so despondent, he killed himself in the basement of his garage, the garage in his basement of his office, sitting in a car with license plates that said, acquit you. And I contacted those people, five attorneys who were named in the article, and they said, there is no way. That's garbage.
So when Eisman turned up dead as supposed suicide.
That's correct.
He was Reconosciuto's attorney?
According to Michael, he was on his visitor list for the next day, happened 24 hours before, and somewhere on his body should have been tickets to Seattle to visit Michael.
By the way, I would note, too, in the suiciding context, that the aforementioned Ron Rewald of BBRDW was the victim of an unsuccessful suicide attempt, very similar to the alleged suicide attempt of Daniel Casolaro. His wrists were slashed, but fortunately he survived.
I'll also mention one other thing. When Michael made the declaration, he stated that he had been threatened by a man named Peter Vitnix of the Justice Department, who had been
right.
the contract officer on Inslaw.
Mm-hmm.
He said that Mr. Vitnix had threatened him by saying that if he continued to cooperate with Jack Brooks, House Judiciary, and the Inslaw people and continue to do declarations, that he would be indicted along with friends in Los Angeles. The friend that they were referring to was Mr. Ferrante of Consolidated Savings and Loan. And there had been an attempt on Mr. Ferrante's life as detailed in the Inside Job.
By the way, the Videnyak's threat against Reconosciuto is covered in the aforementioned miscellaneous archive show about Innslaw called We Have Ways of Making You Sell. And again, caller, I'm citing these references for the benefit of listeners who might not be familiar with this information. Go ahead.
Correct. Mr. Ferrante, when there was an attempt on his life that was very nearly successful, indicated that he had been attacked by the Israeli mafia in the first reports that he gave the police.
Okay.
Coming back to Mr. Reconosciuto at the time of Weissman's death, I was told that if I wanted to make Mr. Reconosciuto's feet light on the ground, because nobody was giving him any credibility at this point, that I had to trace the money, honey. And that's from a man who knows. And so I kept after Michael to please, please, please talk to somebody and tell us how the money, what banks, what people dealt with the money. And he said he would only do that if I could promise him that somebody would get him enough credibility to print it exactly as he gave it to me. And I talked to Harry Martin. Harry Martin said he would have Michael call him. And Harry was as good as his word. He printed it verbatim, just as Michael had been telling us it went, and just as he'd been telling Janice of Channel 9 Australian television that it went down. He was tracing the $40 million involved in the October surprise that was traded in October of 1980.
Right.
Now, one of the names that he named in one of the paragraphs that Harry Martin published was Alan Michael May.
Right, and that's the individual who I mentioned. On June 14th, he was mentioned. He related to Harry Martin that he would appreciate it if his name was not printed because he feared for his life. On Wednesday, June 19th, he died of an apparent heart attack at the ripe old age of 50, and he was in good health. Go ahead.
Correct. And I heard from Michael that Alan and he had had a conversation, and that Alan Michael May had told Michael to sit on your fat Italian ass and keep your mouth shut, and this is a quote, or we're all going to be dead.
Right. And again, the miscellaneous archives series about October Surprise as an addendum, actually not miscellaneous, but the addendum to Radio Free America 31 about October Surprise, accessing the Harry Martin information, has a detailed account of the death of Michael May. Go ahead.
Correct. And recently I talked, after Danny's death, I contacted the coroner, and they indicate to me that they have finally released a death report dated July the 26th. I asked him what the result of that was. He said it was pulmonary failure with complications of diabetes, and the contributory cause was polypharmaceuticals. I asked him what that meant. He said many drugs in the body. I asked the coroner if they were of a nature that were prescribed, and he said no.
Now, this is the death of Alan Michael May?
Correct.
Okay, right. Go ahead.
I do not know, and I have been asked, and I have neglected to contact the family, but there is a common link that goes on in these deaths, and that's the home is broken into or the apartment is broken into, the computer banks are raided, notes and files are taken. Now, in the case of Dexter Jacobson, after his death, his office was broken into twice, his apartment once. And in the case of Anson, the reporter who died in Guatemala, the Guatemalan government took the floppy disks and took notes from his desk that he was working on. Senator Cranston, in a press conference, requested they be returned.
Mm-hmm.
After the death of Alan Michael May, Michael became extremely fearful for his family, and his wife with the children became extremely fearful, and as it turned out, they had good reason to, David.
Mm-hmm.
There were 1981 deaths that were identified in the 1985 television show as a covert government hit, which would mean the CIA was violating its own charter because they occurred on Rancho Mirage.